So the recording has started, and now I'm just going to put this in front of you, and then try to project as loud as you can.
Okay.
And then just speak as loud as you can and have fun.
Okay. Is it already on?
Like, yeah.
Okay,
okay,
perfect.
So who will ask me the questions?
We're going to kind of switch back.
Yeah.
Before.
Okay.
It's going to be very, like, conversational.
Okay,
yeah.
Sounds
and
good.
Very low key.
If I ever do this, it just means be
speak
loud,
up.
A little
okay.
Louder.
Yeah.
And
how can you tell?
I mean, I could just...
Molly's kind of a podcast reporter.
Yeah.
Okay.
She does
okay,
gotcha. She knows this stuff very well.
Sounds good.
Okay. You can go ahead and start.
All right. So welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the TEDxUF podcast.
We're super, super excited to have a former TED speaker with us today, Dr. Chandler. How's it going?
Hi, thank you. It's going wonderful. It's good to be here.
So Dr. Chandler is currently an assistant instructional professor for UF Department of Psychology and the department's undergraduate coordinator. Sounds like a lot, but we'll definitely be breaking that down later in the episode as well. And he also teaches classes in the psychology of sustainability, social psychology, and positive psychology. And
last year, he gave a TED Talk called The Role of Human Dignity in Sustainability, which we'll be getting into a little bit later in this episode. So first... without further ado, Dr. Chandler, do you want to give us and our listeners a little bit of an introduction about yourself?
Sure. Thanks. It's good to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. Just in brief, I was an environmental scientist in different fields of environmental science for about 25 years before I went back and got a doctorate in psychology so that I could start a new field of sustainability education, really, as much as a field of psychology called sustainability psychology. So I teach the introduction to that here at UF. And that was a large part of what my talk was about, my TED Talk was about. So I've been here fully in University of Florida since 2017. So I'm very new, you know, in psychology here, in a relatively speaking. But yeah, so that's my background, basically.
Have you found
here.
That students really, like, is your class a pretty popular one?
Well, it is, pretty much. I think... it's sort of a niche area, you know, if you will, and they have it's grown, of course. So
that's
like the
great.
Average class was around 18 when we first started. It's around 65 or
wow,
70
that's
now.
Awesome.
Now I'm
really,
really grateful.
Good.
I teach
that's
it every
really
semester,
good.
And so even though it is niche a little bit, it is something that's growing. I developed it in my doctoral program so that we'd be transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary. So you do not need to know anything about psychology to start studying and understanding the psychology of sustainability. So I have psychology majors, of course, women's studies, philosophy, environmental engineering, physics,
that's
chemistry professors. Yeah,
I think that's really important because the more people that can learn about something that they're passionate about without having any limits or barriers, that's really incredible.
Right.
That's incredible.
Well, and that's where, that's what motivated me in the first place to go back and get a doc in psychology was that, you know, I got to this point where as much as I loved, and I've talked about this in my TED Talk, you know, as much as I loved ecology, I kept running into this question about why are we doing this to the planet and to
right.
each other?
Right.
And why is a psychological question? You know, why psychology is the science of why. And so that's what, you know, I wanted to make sure that anybody had access to this, to putting psychology, if you will, at the center of the sustainability discussion.
Right, right.
Also the human rights discussion, social justice, you know, environmental, conservation in general. Yeah.
Can you think of like a particular defining moment where you really, that question really sprang to your mind? Like you said, psychology is the science of why. Like, did you ever have like a light bulb moment of, oh my gosh, this is exactly what I want to study? Or was it kind of more gradual over the course?
Well, it was pretty gradual, really. You know, part of it was that I realized that I wasn't going to work in limnology and hydrology were my specialties, if you will. And that's basically, limnologist is like the freshwater version of an oceanographer.
Mm-hmm.
So we study the physical, chemical movement of water, movement of nutrients, contaminants, and things like that. And I did that with flow hydrology. Mm-hmm. And I loved that work, but I realized I wasn't going to do that the rest of my life. So one of the first things I asked myself, okay, if I'm not doing this, what will I do?
Mm-hmm.
And then the first thing that came to mind was save elephants. You know, I mentioned this in the talk,
uh-huh.
but with that, you know, I thought, okay, I know nothing about elephants. What do I do about that now that I've come up with this idea? One thing led to another. And so I co-founded a conservation initiative for the Asian elephant.
Uh-huh.
And we'll be 24 this June.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was you know, that was a big thing. I think that was probably the biggest shift. And then seeing, and then about not too long after that, I went to work, I took a position as a researcher at the Water Atlas at USF. Mm-hmm. And then I also started working in the Graduate School of Architecture, where we were developing this new graduate program. It was like sustainability and built environment. I think we called it ecology and urbanism or something. At any rate, and looking at how the how cities were redeveloping and everything, it was really more just gentrification. So they were getting more efficient and mm-hmm. really cool looking, you know, neat stormwater areas and things like that. They were actually displacing 90% of the people that were living there.
That's crazy.
And so then I started thinking about that, and I went back to my original question, the question that had been haunting me all this time, why are we doing this?
Right.
And the other part of it, how can this be sustainable, right? If we displace most of the people that need to live here. That's when at USF is when I decided that I'd go back to school and develop my skills in psychology.
Is the program that you created there still standing at the school at USF?
Sure. Sure, the ecology is urbanism?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's still there.
That's
yeah,
really
yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
really cool. And jumping back, why elephants?
You know, I've always loved elephants.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so I read a lot about them, and I was really passionate about them. But you know, being from Texas, you know, and being in limnology and hydrology, and you know all this, and that, you know, there are no elephants
right,
in the States
right.
to speak of. Unfortunately, those that are around are in captivity for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought that was what I needed to do. So I just
that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Because just fun story, I actually, when I was, I think, 7 years old, I went back to India to visit my grandparents and stuff. And there was like a temple we went into, and they were like, there was an elephant standing there, and they were like, do you want to ride the elephant?
So
and
it was
then,
a real elephant.
It was a real
oh,
elephant.
Okay, okay.
And
I said, no,
it's a real one. And then I said, yeah. And then I like sat on it, and it's a crazy experience. It's like surreal. They're so big.
Yeah.
They're
I just
such
remember.
Intelligent creatures.
It's crazy.
Too.
They are so calm, and like, yeah, they are amazing.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, I discourage the kind of riding that a lot of the tourists do, where they ride on the houses, the platforms.
Right.
But if you can ride on their shoulders like a mahout does,
yeah,
you know, that's a transporting experience. It really is, because they don't, you know, no matter how big of a person we are, basically, that's
uh-huh.
nothing for them.
Yeah.
One person on their shoulder, and there's something about that is really.
Yeah. Have you ever? Ridden on an elephant.
I have, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah just like
cool.
that.
Mm-hmm. That's so cool.
But I've walked with them too in line, and what's really cool, if you get in between them, they'll often stick their tail out so you
uh-huh.
grab their tail, and the one behind you will put their trunk out so you can grab their trunk.
That's so
and it doesn't
cute.
Hurt yeah. them or anything. It's just like.
They, that's how they want you to be in
oh,
line
that's
and connect
so
with them.
Cute.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that so much.
No, they're extreme. You know, they have more processing capability than our laptops do combined. So, you know, that they're extraordinarily intelligent.
They possess like a really unique like awareness
yeah.
that I think a lot of like higher
they do.
Animals do.
And
know.
They manage communication, a complexity of communication that rivals dolphins and whales. I mean, they can adjust their signals, you know, so that they know about how far they want to transmit and to whom and how complex they want to send a message. And so they know the terrain, they know who's out there, they want to talk with them. If they need to just say, we're here, come see us, or we're here, there's a danger between us, or they want to send something over a really rough terrain, then they change how they package their information.
Yeah, awesome. That's
and so much of it is, you know, we can't hear it, we can only feel it.
That's wild.
Feel it in the ground, yeah.
That's really
yeah.
awesome. And you know, that actually, that bridges to our next question for you.
Okay.
We wanted to ask what your connection to TEDxUF was that led you to give this talk about your elephants and the psychology of sustainability.
Yeah.
Like, how did you get involved?
Well, so I was nominated by two colleagues that also gave TED Talks different times.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and so I actually got an email from someone that said, you know, and I don't know if I should mention their name or not because I didn't ask them about this, but anyway, two TED Talkers.
Okay.
They have nominated you, and we wanted to know if you might be interested in an initial interview and, you know, filling out the application.
Right,
so
right.
that's how I.
And how did you feel when you got that email? Were you like shocked, or were you like, this is something I've always wanted to do, or nervous, or how did
you know, I really didn't know. So the first thing I did was I emailed my two friends, my two colleagues, and
right.
I said, you know, I understand that you nominated me.
So you didn't know they'd nominated
no.
you.
No. I thought, oh, yeah, we were going to tell you, we just forgot.
Oh, boy.
You know, so, but
that must have been quite the shock.
Yeah.
It was. And that I did not know, so Lori and Ryan, I did not know how much they put into it, into mm-hmm. the talk. But mm-hmm. so one of the things I have trouble with is even though I love to be in the classroom and all, I'm sort of a strategic introvert mm-hmm. in that I love people, but I have to figure out how to do that.
Right.
And okay. so the thought of being, like I saw them in a TED talk, being the center of attention with hundreds of people around me, it wasn't anything that I was really passionate about.
Wow, doing, okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And then so how was that, then how did you sort of like jumpstart that process? Like what was the process like of creating the TED talk and everything
Well, let's see. The first part of it was, there was a kind of a lengthy application. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have done that, but yeah, lengthy application. And then that goes out. And then basically they let you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, if you get a first interview, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. So I got an interview, and I thought that went well. But, what I wanted to present was, wasn't quite sure if it resonated with the people that were interviewing
right,
me.
Right, right.
So I thought, well, that's nice. You know, it was a good interview and everything, and I can let this go and get on about my business.
Well,
I was
like,
but then they messaged me a few days later and said, we'd like to interview you again.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh my God, this could actually happen.
That's when it started. Really,
what's my exit strategy at this point? Right. But yeah. And anyway, so one thing led to another. And then we had the group of speakers and basically the whole TEDxUF team met for just like a orientation sort of pizza and things. And then you sort of, you tell them kind of what sort of personality you'd like to have for your coach.
Mm-hmm.
Male, female, you know, vivacious, directive, controlling, you know, laid back, whatever mm-hmm. like this. So I gave them my thoughts on that. And then I met Malika Jane. You mm-hmm. guys know Malika, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the best thing that ever happened as far as she was fantastic.
She speaks very highly of you.
Oh, well. I think in one of the questions, you say, what was a highlight of the process?
Mm-hmm.
It was Malika, yeah.
Aww,
for
that's
sure.
Really
yeah,
nice.
Absolutely.
That's
yeah.
amazing. Mm-hmm. And so when you started that process and everything, what do you think was the biggest challenge that you faced? Was it writing the speech, or was it maybe more delivering the speech? How did it?
You know, when it came time to actually just walk out there and deliver the speech, I felt like I was in another domain.
Really?
Yeah, it was just but the longest distance that I've ever traversed of however many thousands of miles I've hiked or whatever was that, 25 feet between backstage and that red dot.
Right.
That is pure torture. But but then after that, it just seemed like everything started falling into place.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then
it's 9 months of practice.
It is.
An intense process.
I jumped my script actually in one part of it because I went to another part, but because we had worked on it so much that when I got to another part that was ideal to put that second part that I missed in it,
right.
I just brought it in there. And the guy that was running the PowerPoint, he saw that coming, and he basically went, oh, wait. And he put the slide up exactly where I was.
That's
he
so
he followed
amazing.
The cue. So they were very much in tune to the speakers.
Machine,
it really
right?
is,
That's
yeah.
That's really great.
Yeah, and so, but, yeah, but what's up? But the process, though, is really, you know, you have to stay with it, and,
mm-hmm.
and Malika was fantastic about, we set schedules and we'd get together. She'd bring chai sometimes, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, we'd have a coffee or whatever, and we'd do that, and we'd work on it. And then I would most of the time keep my schedule,
mm-hmm.
you know, and send the drafts back of the script.
Mm-hmm.
And then roughly halfway through it, I looked at my script, and I thought, you know, I can't do this.
Really?
I'm out with this because I have
what
to.
What did Malika say?
Well, so I basically waited until we met next time, and I said I've written another script.
Uh-huh.
I can't give the one that we're halfway into.
Yeah.
It just for whatever reason it's no longer resonating with me. It's not my story. It's
right.
a story.
Right. Right.
Something like that. And so she just took a deep breath and she said, "Well, it's not the first time. please don't do it again,
uh-huh.
sir." But yeah. So then I did, and I wrote, and that's the script that we had, and that's the script that I felt like I could tell the rest of my life because it's
right.
so much a part of how I feel about things and what my work is in sustainability
right.
psychology and my work for SciFi for the elephants.
Right, right.
For human dignity is what the focus is.
And I think that is really important that you did
mm-hmm.
do that switch. Otherwise, doing an inauthentic talk, I feel like that probably would have shown. You know what I mean?
Well, the first one was it had what I thought was a lot of cool stories or
mm-hmm.
interesting stories about what it was like being a field ecologist in
mm-hmm.
Texas, of all things, during one of the oil booms. you know, and during the, in the culture, being, mm-hmm. you know, a progressive liberal, you know, ecologist and all that,
right.
in that environment was a different place to be, for mm-hmm. sure. But there were stories about that and right. then some things, but it just didn't actually get to it until I started thinking about the whole point of this is mm-hmm. that the shift had to be towards the human condition, human dignity, and understanding psychology, you know, in the presence of all these things.
Right.
That's great. And you know that, like, really that, it's really cool that you talk about, like, all these little parts of your talk, like, that sort of connect to each part of your life, that sort of, like, summated in a really cool way that you were able to present to people in a way that, you know, you felt authentic to yourself. Why don't you give us a little bit, like, tell us a little bit more about the talk itself. Like,
okay.
Give us a little summary of
that I remember?
What was in the talk.
A little bit that I remember.
It doesn't have to be anything specific. Just
yeah.
give us like,
yeah.
a general idea. Like, talk us through your thought process.
Well, it's so, okay, let me think about it. Because every now and then I find myself still, but that was April, so we're working on a year now,
mm-hmm.
right?
Uh-huh.
Working on a year, sometimes I'll be like writing a canvas and I'll be going through that script again.
That's
you know,
amazing.
I'm thinking, this is so crazy. You know, I can really let this go. And if I ever forget it, I have it written down. And also it's on YouTube,
uh-huh.
you know? And the views, though, have really grown. It's
really?
Like at 500,000.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
That is amazing.
It was one of these things, like, come winter break, you know, it was kind of teetering around 500 or 600 views.
Wow.
And then I asked a lot of people about it. I said,
yeah.
what, you know, how do you get your talk to actually grow so that at some point you might be able to use that to get more attention for the
mm-hmm.
elephants, more attention for human dignity and
right.
for indigenous and so on. And some people said, you know, sometimes they get traction, so to speak, and sometimes they don't.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you can pay like a, there are these, you know, kind of high-profile promoters that also use your talk as leverage for their marketing and things like that. You can pay them a bunch of money. And I don't know if I should say this or not, because I don't know if people do this, but I think they do. Not, I don't know they do it for TED Talks, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can get promoters to do it and pay, and they supposedly
right.
grow your viewership. But
mm-hmm.
at any rate. Yeah, so it's good to see.
Which I think is good, especially if there's something, like, you've talked about things that are really personal to you and also really important for others to hear, all about sustainability, everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that everyone should hear. So the more people that we can have listening to the talk, the better.
That's exactly
yeah.
right. You know, whether or not I ever get a chance to like, give talks, or what I'd like to do, give talks, especially if I could find a way to help other psychology departments, or even environmental science, put sustainability psychology in their programs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just go there, help them get the program started. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
But you know that there's that right column on YouTube's YouTube channel.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think what that's where they call their high profile or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about a million or more views on each of those. Some of them have 10 or 15 million.
Wow.
Crazy.
But I think that's what it takes to get over there, and then something happens, magical happens.
Yeah.
Like,
hey, fingers crossed,
you're
already halfway there.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
That's a pretty huge step in the right direction.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm grateful for that, you know. But so as far as the talk goes, it was just the being in the back room with the other TED Talkers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just kind of going over it, and we were thinking about it. Gosh, you know, 1 hour, you know, I'll be speaking, then Connie will be speaking, so on and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And we're just thinking about this, and then you get out there, and you just start talking about it. You hear yourself talking, but it's sort of like you're a little bit of an out-of-body experience.
It's like you're watching it from third person.
Yeah, exactly. And you're seeing people's faces, and a lot of my students were there, which is a beautiful
Aww.
Experience. Seeing their faces there, and friends, you know, friends and family were there. My
yeah.
brother came in from Boston. And,
wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's so exciting.
And so just seeing everybody there, and it was so energizing. The only thing that was really challenging at that point was to not get distracted by everybody being there and,
mm-hmm.
and talking to them.
Because losing your train of thought in the middle of the talk
is
yeah.
right.
really disruptive.
Yeah,
right.
as opposed to like giving it out instead of connecting that way.
Right.
So it was hard for me because in class I love to connect with their faces, you know,
right.
like a raised eyebrow typically means tell me what's on your mind.
Right, right.
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. And so how about then for those of the listeners who maybe haven't heard your TED Talk, we're definitely going to be linking that down in the description box. So make sure you check that out. But how about you just give like a brief summary of your talk, sort of like the main points that you hit and what you want our listeners to hear about your talk.
Okay. Let's see. The first message is that is that we must develop a healthy environmental identity. I mean, mm-hmm. so the need for us to be connected with nature isn't simply a nice therapeutic idea. Right. It's essential, right?
Right.
It's actually hardwired in our genes. The further we get away from a true connection and appreciation for nature, we're getting that much further away from mental wellness.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a key part of that. And it was the first part of the message, and that was, I talked about rebuilding my sense of self when we moved from rural Florida to East Dallas and these things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I found ecology to be this restorative experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied it, didn't realize how restorative it was, like psycho-spiritually, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really very, very important. That was the first part. And then I talked about sort of going through working as an ecologist and what that was like to finally get to the point where, am I going to be okay doing this the rest of my life, or with what time I have left, will I actually work towards the question why?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was another big part of that. Kind of mixed in with that was when I decided to do something for elephants, and that's
right.
where SIFI Conservation Initiative came
in. It all sort of tied together.
Sort of started, you know, just flowing in together. You know, it wasn't a plan. I didn't plan this, you know, at all. But my intention to get a doc in psychology was planned, but beyond that, what to do with it, I wasn't quite sure.
Right.
Yeah. And then the last thing I think, and probably the message that most people seem to resonate with, is I talked about we all seek to improve our sense of dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about dignity is how we feel about ourselves, how we think others feel about us, and how we, if we can care for ourselves and care for others, and the other part of it is our connection with nature. All of us, no matter whether we realize it or not, actually have a desire, some of us a passion, to build that connection with nature, to improve our dignity.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we have a very, very misguided idea of how that might work.
Mm-hmm.
And I compared and contrast some boys and young men that had gotten looped into poaching, slaughtering elephants and rhinos by the poaching overlords, told they'd get money, they'd get drugs, they'd get women, they would have all these things, and they'd be powerful in their community.
Mm.
You know, so they'd be lifted up, right? So they did that thinking in a way, a twisted way, if you will, mm-hmm. that they would actually bolster their own dignity. The other side of it was, when we worked with the Garo people in the Garo Hills in Meghalaya, India, was that my dear friend and colleague Kashmira, Dr. Kotke, she recruited boys and young men from the villages, the Garo villages, and taught them how to be field scientists. And she worked with them, and they worked together. I forget, we actually deployed 400 sites with camera traps.
That's
wow.
To actually identify the Garo Hills as truly one of the most biodiverse places on the planet. Those boys and young men got to do that.
Uh-huh.
They not only worked with each other, they worked with a brilliant scientist, they actually did something that was good for their people,
uh-huh.
for their entire future, for the entire region, you know?
Uh-huh. And they got to sort of transform their, like,
exactly. It
of,
bolstered
like,
their dignity.
Versus, like,
yeah. They would go back to their villages, and they would tell their parents, their wives, their people, you know, sit around and say, this is what we were doing, and they were so proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so both those two groups were trying to improve their sense of self, their dignity. One, obviously, was a very disastrous
mm-hmm.
Approach or response,
right?
You know,
right.
And the other one was a very positive one. So that was how I kind of
interesting.
You know, contrasted those. Yeah.
That's amazing, and it really is that connection to nature
mm-hmm.
that really brings. That's incredible.
Right. We cannot bolster our dignity by destroying nature. It's 100% in error.
yeah, for sure.
Right.
And then, so how about when was it? Were you always like growing up? Were you always really interested in nature and stuff, or when did you really realize that you had a passion for it?
Yeah, no, I think that spending a lot of time in rural Florida, coastal Florida,
mm-hmm.
our mother was raised us and was just really encouraged us to get out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course we got swim lessons and things like that, so we would
yeah.
always get outside. And even when we moved to East Dallas, uh-huh. she said, "There's a creek down at the end of the street. Go play in it." You know, whatever the case might be. No, we really connected with that. And that was really, it was really a very important connection when we did move.
Right.
And everything seemed to be gone, you know, and
yeah.
all that was that connection with nature.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And then so maybe, do you have any advice for the listeners on maybe how they can connect with nature more and maybe sort of get out there? Because I do know there are so many people who do struggle maybe finding their purpose with mental health, all mm-hmm. sorts of things, or just generally want to get outside more. So what advice do you have for people to go and experience and connect with nature more?
Sure. Well, Okay, the first thing that came to mind, well, there's a theory called environmental identity, and it's Susan Clayton is the and Karen Opoto developed that. But the environmental identity, one part of it that's talked about is environmental numbness.
Mm-hmm.
So we it's essential that we develop a healthy environmental identity. Part of that is to remove factors that create an environmental numbness. That's earbuds.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a funny story that I tell my students too. But it's earbuds, headphones. It's, you know, like it's managing to find some other way than to listen first to ourselves and then listen to nature.
It adds in like a third blocker.
Yeah,
it really does. Yeah.
Yeah. So the one story that I shared, there's so many stories like this, but this is just one that happened. I was walking up to the science library, and a palm swallow flew. Flew out from a tree, and so a girl that I was walking up the stairs with saw them too, and I said palm swallows like that, and so she went what, and I said palm swallows, and then she went what, and took out like this, and I said palm swallows, she went oh cool, put it back.
That's so depressing. Oh, my
God. Well, so that, I mean, it's the, we, I think we all do it. We like podcasts, we like TED Talks, we like music and things like that. The thing is though, when we walk across campus, you know, the biodiversity of UF campus is really amazing.
You know,
the hawks are breeding now, right? So if you
see they're everywhere. I saw them all over the
They're snow. They're breeding now. So there's dozens of pairs right there around, what is it, Plaza of the Americas.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
That's like right where we are. That's
so cool.
Right.
And it's really it's interesting because I think there was also a point in time, I think probably beginning of freshman year, when I realized that I would also like put in headphones, put something, like my brain had to be working on something else rather than my own thoughts or connecting with like the world around me. So then when I started, like I live at Lakeside Residential Comm, so there's like the lake house and everything. Then I started going there and then I started realizing like, wait a minute, there's so much beautiful nature, and it got to the point where I don't need to wear headphones anymore. I just like I have them off, and that's so true. It really does connect you with everything.
Just hit me, palm warblers, not swallows. Palm warblers.
Okay.
I don't know if that matters. You put that in, but that's, you know, that just happens so much. Not to mention that if we actually want to avoid an environmental numbness, we're actually safer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're walking, especially if you're walking alone or you're walking with just a small group of people, you're doing something. Maybe you're taking a shortcut through downtown or something make sure you can hear, put the phone down, look around.
It's also like have you seen people when they ride mopeds? Like they ride them with headphones in and without a helmet. I'm like, are you insane? Like, are you literally insane? I don't know. It's like, I don't know. I could never do that. But I was walking to Library West the other day, and I saw like a gigantic ibis like right outside outside of the library, and like I'm from Wisconsin, like ibises don't really just like flock around in random places there. So like when I saw like a flock of them for the first time freshman year outside of like where I lived, I was like, oh my God, and I got on my phone, I was like, this is so cool.
It really is. It's beautiful, and it's right here, you know.
It's crazy.
It's right here.
So this is sort of like our final question for you. We sort of saved the best for last. As a TED speaker, if you had to give tips for people who want to be TED speakers, give them like your top five tips that you can think of, either for like sort of gathering the courage to start an application, or maybe like entertaining like an idea they have, how to develop it into a TED talk. Just no pressure. Speak from your experience. And it doesn't have to be five.
That's can even be what you learned, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I think that what convinced me to take the risk of doing it is because I felt like I had a message, you know, and that was about the centrality of human dignity, in sustainability especially, and how it's not just important, it's essential, it's vital that we have a connection, that we find a way to improve our dignity through nature.
Right.
So that was the message. So I thought, you know, who will I be if I don't try?
Right.
You know, so that was part of it. So I would say that. I think everyone has something to say. If you feel really passionate about a message, something you really have to say, especially if it resonates from a sense of self, a better sense of self, and it can help others feel that way too, something that would be, you know, that would resonate with people and want them to feel better about themselves, to improve their lives, then take the chance. You know, that would be the first one. Be patient. Be patient with yourself.
Yeah.
And be okay with not being comfortable with it. Pick a good coach. I mean, that, you know, just like, go back to Malika. She was, it was amazing. I thought basically anyone else might not have worked at all, you know, because of the way
it fits so
well.
Yeah.
And I don't know if people start with a coach and then change coaches or anything.
The process, I think, is, like, as a speaker coach, I can tell you, like, the process is a little different for every team organization, but the way we do it is pretty methodical each year with the speaker coach pairings.
Yeah, so. It was fun. And Arisha did a great job, you know, keeping all the troops in line and that kind of thing. Let's see. Well, I'm not aware if I'm a bit second or third or fourth, but with the points, you stay on task. You know, keep the schedule. You know, don't take it lightly. Every single time you go through a script, that's just one step better to making sure when you get on the stage that you have it.
Mm-hmm.
Stay on schedule. Always stay in contact with your coach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, meet as often as you can. Mm-hmm. I think we've met twice a week sometimes, once a week, depending.
Right.
And then the other part of kind of connected that, or it might be the fifth suggestion, would be once you start making those videos, those trial videos or training videos,
mm-hmm.
you know, be religious almost with those. Really stay at those.
Right.
Those were hugely helpful.
Recording. And mm-hmm. for our listeners, this is the coach that the, this is kind of the process that the coach and the speaker go through towards, like, closer to the conference.
Right.
We speaker coaches have the speakers record videos of themselves giving the talks as they're slowly starting to memorize them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, was it weird for you to go back and, like, watch the video of yourself giving
the
talk?
So awkward.
And I know that, like, if it was me, I hate listening to myself over and over.
Yeah, I got over it because I had to. But, oh, that the other part of it is just be okay with that first time you get in front of the TED team
mm-hmm.
and you give your first trial or pilot talk or whatever, mm-hmm. and they want to take your notes away from you, you know? you can hang on to them.
Yeah.
That's okay, but that's a tough one there. But that really, I think that there might be a little bit of a something with, especially if you know what you want to say and you have a good idea, you know what your script's in your head, you think, I can do this, just let me get up there and let's be done with all this rehearsal and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case. There's that weird energy there
mm-hmm.
that suddenly when you get up in front of people, even though you think you know what you're about to say, then that sort of goes away.
Right.
You know,
right.
So I would just say stay vigilant with the practice videos.
And yeah, I think that's what makes TED speakers so special, is because not only do they have something amazing to say and something to give to the world out there, but there's also that element of being real, consistency, diligence, putting all the work in. And these are some, I think, skills that people shy away from, or they don't want to put in that work, or they're scared or intimidated by it. But yeah, I'm really, with your advice, you know, hopefully that inspires our listeners to maybe put in that work, because it really brings them to places and experiences.
Sure. And there's so many people that have such a valuable message.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is the perfect vehicle
getting
that out there.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the end of our episode for this week. Thank you so much, Dr. Chandler,
for
taking the time to join us. I know I'm
going
to be going back and listening to this and texting Malika. So thank you so much everything.
Yes, and for our listeners out there, again, I just want to point out that Dr. Ron Chandler's TED Talk is going to be linked in the description below. Make sure to check it out. And if you enjoyed the episode, feel free to give it a rating as well.
We'll see you next time on our podcast, Let's TED Talk About It.
Yay.
Good job, Dr. Chandler.
Yeah, you did amazing.
I
hope it wasn't too pressured. It was really very low-key.
Okay.
I would love to take a picture of you guys.
Yes.